Vision 2020 UK.
Welcome to the Vision 2020 UK podcast. In this edition of the podcast, presented by me, John Wellsman, we're in conversation with
Jenny Cook. I am Head of Strategy and Research at Guide Dogs, where I have been an employee for 11 years. But I also chair the Vision 2020 Children and Young People's Group.
I started my conversation with Jenny by asking her, why does Vision 2020 UK have a Children and Young People's Committee?
It's a very specific area. It's a very special interest group that I chair. I mean, the issues for children and young people are very specific around age, around education, around health and social care. And there are specialist services and an individual pathway for children and young people across the UK. So it's important that we are working together to highlight those issues and to ensure that we all speak with one voice across all those different aspects of support that's needed.
And we're recording this podcast in 2017. What is the big picture question or the big picture issue that the committee is looking at the moment?
There are around about five different areas that the committee is looking at. When you look at the children and young persons pathway across the UK, there are still issues about integrating that pathway across health, social care, education, and making sure that voices are joined up and that a person-centred approach is very much at the heart of that. And the areas in specifically that we are targeting, that we know from years of working together as an interest group, are around eye screening and eye tests, leading on from that into certification of vision impairment and registration, because there is a lack of children's services in these areas. Early years support is an area that we as a group recognise that if you don't give that support in the very early years of life, it has a knock-on effect for the life chances of that child or young person. And then also into secondary school and the transition across into adulthood are particularly critical as children grow and develop and become young adults and independent in their own right. So there's some very broad but very deep topics that we are looking at, all of which cover the four devolved administrations of the UK.
So before we get into those topic areas specifically, you mentioned the word pathways, and I'm sure for some of our listeners they'll be more than familiar with what pathways mean. What does pathways mean in the context of your understanding of the committee's work?
A good description for me, it's about the journey of working with a child, a young person, their family or their carer, from really the identification of what may be a potential vision impairment to then that individual being able to live life on their own terms and in their own way, and through a series of connectivity between the different parts of health and social care and education that you have to access to get to that point where the child and young person can live the life they choose.
So before we dip into those questions individually, is that a challenge in its own right, drawing all those sectors of society together to in a sense speak with one voice and provide a service with one voice?
Yes, it is. It's all, as always with everything else that is related to the public sector currently at the moment, it is all around budgets and prioritisation and demand, getting your voice heard. There have been moves over the last couple of years about integrating health and social care, and in particular for children and young people, integrating health, social care and education. And we've certainly seen that happening in Scotland. We certainly have the new Families Act in England that has brought that into the code of practice, and we're starting to see that develop and build more momentum in Wales as well, with Northern Ireland to follow. So things are becoming more joined up, but it's around the capacity of the professionals to get round the table to talk in a joined up way at the same time about the support and care that individuals personally need, and I suppose that's the biggest issue.
Let's dip into some of the work of the committee. And the first one on my list here, which you mentioned already, is eye screening and testing. Why for the person who's come to this fresh listening to the podcast, is that important?
It is an issue that we as a group come back and discuss time and time again. And there must be about 30 different groups represented around the table, which shows why these areas that we're looking at come up as themes in our discussions and we look at the evidence. But what we do believe in is that the detection of visual problems and eye disorders in children needs to be done at an appropriate age, and the younger the better, and that early detection is important for improving the provision and the outcomes for children with eye disease. And it's really about picking it up at a very early stage so that if there is something that can be prevented or corrected or maintained, that actually it starts at that very young age, or at whatever point that child may have a referral to look at an identification of a potential vision impairment.
So is this something, from your understanding, that's done as a matter of course as a screening exercise for all children, or are we looking at this as a priority for children where there's some feeling from a specialist that there is a problem with the child's eyesight?
It is, to answer the question, it is both. It is screening for children at a young age, for example, in England, screening of children in reception years. And the British and Irish Orthoptic Society have done a lot of work looking into this, looking at where screening is and isn't happening. But it's also around children who potentially it may be identified, or parents are concerned that they then get the appropriate screening and or eye test to accompany it.
I may be making an assumption here that if this is a priority, do we assume then that it's not being done, or it's not being done as effectively as it could be done, e.g. there's possibly a postcode lottery?
There is absolutely a postcode lottery, and it differs again within the devolved administrations of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. They have different policies and ways of looking at eye screening and eye testing. But there is an organisation that's leading on it, which is BIOS, and we are absolutely supportive and behind their messaging and the work that they are doing.
So we have eye tests as a separate issue. Obviously, I realise there's some interrelationship with that, but is there something specific about eye tests with children and young people which is of particular concern to the committee?
It's really about ensuring that children and young people have regular eye tests. A very good example is the fact that I actually chair the committee themselves. I have two sons, 1 6, 1 8. I actually got the phone call from school saying, "Mrs. Cook, I think you need to take your son for an eye test." If anyone should have known that they needed to take their child for an eye test, it was me. And he is short-sighted and he does need to wear glasses. And it is about that messaging out to parents that, you know, you need to look after your child's sight, you need to make sure that they do have regular eye tests. And we see figures out across on media channels and across the news about people taking their children to the dentist. We know that people are even less likely to take their child for an eye test.
Do you think it is the responsibility of the parent, or is there some role to play from the educational professional, the teacher in the school, who notices some of those challenges?
Yes, I think it's a combination of both, and it's very much about, my example is a very apt one. The teacher phoned me up and said, you know, you need to take your child for an eye test. Ironically, my husband and I are both short-sighted, so we should have known. And it is around that public messaging, but it is about public health together, making sure that people understand the need in this area and to get the messaging right.
Uniquely, blind and partially sighted people are certificated, and I notice on the list here we talk about certification and registration. So do I assume from that then that the landscape for certification and registration of children and young people is different to adults?
It is, and the issue that we have is more around the fact that there are few paediatric professionals out there available to provide and give advice and support, and particularly the emotional support around the process of certification of a vision impairment and registration. And a lot of the children and young people and the case studies and examples that we hear are around children and young people that have gone through this process, but having been through an adult eye clinic process where the messaging and the advice is not right for that child or young person and isn't tailored to be able to explain it to that child and young person in a way that they can understand why this is important to them and what this actually means to them. I mean, there are arguments that there is a huge amount of work to be done in the adult
yes.
area yeah. around this as well. And therefore, I know that this is an area that Vision 2020 is going to look at holistically. And although we're looking at it in a bit more detail in children and young people, the work that we're doing is being pulled up into a larger piece of work across Vision 2020 for children, young people and adults around certification of vision impairment and registration.
Now, is the issue with that that the consensus would be that there should be some specialists who have the ability or the understanding to assess children and young people, or are we asking that ophthalmologists and the like in general have a broad base of knowledge which would encompass children as well as adults?
The answer is I don't know yet. But I think it's about the emotional engagement. It's about the time and the capacity of the individual who was recommending or actually writing out the paperwork for certification or registration. They don't have the time, they don't have the capacity, the eye clinics are full, and they're pushing people through. So it isn't necessarily a criticism either of the people who are undertaking this task. It is about looking at the framework, it's about looking at the processes, it's looking at the system, and looking at it in its holistic way to look at where recommendations can have maximum impact to change the experience of people who have to go through this process.
And the second part of that is that registration process. Now, again, there's some unique elements to registering someone as blind or partially sighted which are unique to the vision impairment world. Why is that registration so important for children and young people? I mean, maybe just for adults, and so it's vision impaired people in general.
It's not for everyone. Not everybody would like to see a registration form around their child's disability. Not everybody feels it is necessary or needed. And fully accept and understand that. And it's about the choice. And I think that's part of it, is that people actually understanding what this actually means, which is part of the question you're asking. And the second part of it is around the fact that actually it does bring some benefits with it, that you around entitlements, support in school, education, health and care plans, in England that is, you know, joining up the process. So it comes with benefits, but then again it can also be seen as a stigmatism for that child throughout their life. So it has to be thought about in its broadest way for people to then understand the needs and wants and the benefits that it can bring. Mm-hmm. Because for everyone it's not a benefit, and for others it brings great benefits.
We move on to early year support. I notice there's a theme in these things, and I suspect there's some degree of interconnectivity between them all, but what is early year support?
Early year supports is really support with children and young people with a vision impairment preschool. So this is very much about children with a very early diagnosis in life, or even identification of potential vision impairment in life, that the help and support that they need to develop at a very young age is given to them at that point. So, for example, we know that 70% of learning is done through vision. Even the basics of standing, crawling, how to hold your head up, how to move your arms and your legs. If you can't see, you're not taking those cues from elsewhere in the world. And it's making sure that children and young people with a vision impairment get the support, the basics of learning at a very, very young age in order to increase their life chances in what we already know is going to be a difficult and complex world for them.
And who would do that? Because obviously I suspect there would be some mechanism within the education system once that child had reached a primary school level. But if you're talking about children having that sort of support beforehand, who would be there to support them?
You've got social care, you've got the statutory providers, you'd be expecting the health visitor to have a role in helping the identification of that through the statutory providers. You know, they're often contracting organisations such as Guide Dogs Children's Habilitation Services. other specialist nurseries, or even that one-to-one care, depending on whether that child is entitled to a personal independent payment to be able to then be able to spend on ensuring that that child's needs are therefore being met. So many different ways, but it is a complex and complicated framework, and unless you actually know what to ask for, you're not going to ask for it. And there's a real role to be played in empowering parents with the knowledge of what, firstly, that vision impairment potentially means for that child, but secondly, what support is actually out there that they're entitled to, that they can ask for help and support with, in order to support not just the child, but them themselves with their emotional needs in working with the child.
Let's assume you've upskilled the parent in what they should be looking for in supporting their child and themselves in their child's development. Are the mechanisms there then to support that in that specialist arena of vision impairment as opposed to some of the other areas of child development and child care?
Comes back to a conversation we had earlier about it being a postcode lottery. Depends which country in the UK you live in, and then comes down to which local authority you are part of. So it really does depend within that. We also have to recognise that children and the young people with a vision impairment are likely to have other disabilities in addition to a vision impairment that may need additional help and support with. So it really does depend on the child, but what we do know is that things seem to be getting harder, there seems to be less available. But that's not just in the sight loss world, that's across the pan disability field, as we know.
And do we know why things are getting more difficult? Is it the obvious? Is it the financial situation that government and the relevant authorities find themselves in at the moment?
Yes, it's the funding needs, it's the pressure of social care needs with the growing elderly market, with the pushback on local authorities for spending. There's a huge push for, obviously, budgets to be driven at a very local level. We do also know that from a vision impairment point of view, it's not a huge disability group. It's a hugely important group, but it's not a very large percentage in the wider disability field. And the voices in all of the different groups are getting louder and louder as the services shrink and shrink. And I think it's about us becoming more savvy in how we work and grouping more with the wider sensory loss sector and then with the broader disability sector to ensure that we are all getting the slice of the pie that is needed to support children and young people across the UK with a vision impairment.
Does that almost put an argument in place then for professionals in those fields actually to be multidisciplinary in terms of the range of disabilities that they're able to support?
I don't know. I'm not an expert. I'm a social researcher and do strategy for a living. Yeah. I think I would leave the more sort of clinical experts to answer that question.
Marvellous. Secondary education then.
Yes.
So that's obviously plays a very important part in anybody's development. Those are your formative years, aren't they? Those are the years where you establish yourself as an individual. What are the areas of work that the committee's focusing on there?
We're not ignoring primary schools, I want to put that out there at the moment, but we do know that children tend to get slightly more support in primary schools. There are smaller groups, more one-to-one in the classroom, and that all in all, there are places that have issues in primary schools, but where we do find there is a significant change is when children do that transition between primary to secondary school. Mm. And it is a huge leap for any child, never mind a child with a vision impairment, to go from quite a small primary school into a large secondary school, which could have, you know, thousands of children all milling and moving around at the same time. Firstly, there's the whole piece about that child getting to the new school in the first place and being empowered to be able to move around that school in an appropriate way to them. But the other part of it is that we know that because of the volume of children and the type of support that is needed, the children and young people aren't getting it, and we know that it does affect attainment in GCSEs, in A-levels, in hires, and all the other qualifications that are given across the UK. And it's to do with accessible formats, it's to do with being able to digitally enhance work that's being done, to have kit and equipment available to children, right through to be able to participate in group activities without being singled out. Being included in everything that that school's doing. And it means teachers and schools not doing things at an ad hoc last minute moment, but planning in advance, thinking ahead how they include children, how they include everyone, so that everybody gets to participate in a way that's meaningful to them. And it's really not happening in a lot of our secondary schools at the moment. And again, it comes back to the fact that sight loss is such a small percentage. We do have qualified teachers of the vision impaired. We do know we've got a succession plan issue with those qualifications moving forward. A lot of people who traditionally worked in this field are close to retirement age. Mm. And they are being replaced by teaching assistants who are all very well intentioned, but are not skilled in really being able to support a child with a vision impairment, young person with a vision impairment, to really attain what they are capable of doing.
I'm sure there are some people at the moment shouting their iPods and going, what about specialist education in terms of specialist schools? Now, I grew up in the veneer in the 1960s and 70s where I went to a school for vision impaired people because the thinking was that my education was likely to be better going to this school where the total specialism centred around vision impairment. Why didn't that feature in your sort of previous comments?
There are still schools for children with disabilities. And also schools just for children with visual impairment. Mm. And, you know, there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. It depends on what is best for that child and young person, their families and carers and their needs. However, often those schools are not within the local area or travelling distance of the family that that young person comes from, and therefore the choice that is available to them is their mainstream school education, and that is it. Mm. But actually that may be what's right for that child and young person. It does come back to the fact that this all has to be a very person-centred approach, and it's not just about the child and young person, it's also about the family and the family group and what works for them as a unit and what works for them within their communities. And it's really about having that choice.
And do you feel confident that there are specialists in the education field out there who can make an assessment adequately to say, well, actually, this child would be better off in a specialist school, or this child would be better off with supported mainstream education?
It's not for an educationist to make that choice.
Right.
It's for an educationist and the social worker and the health worker, whoever it may be, to sit down with the family and to have the conversation, and for them to make sure that they do whatever is appropriate for their needs. Mm. They can listen to the advice, they can all the rest of it, but it has to be very much a person-centred decision as to what is best for that child and family.
You mentioned transition earlier, and from a previous life I'm very familiar with the transition from mainstream education into further education, or into get qualifications, you know, in a trade or something else like that. Why is this transition period so important for the committee's work?
RNIB have been doing some brilliant research over the last couple of years looking at the issues of basically secondary education through into transition and into adulthood and into employment, and all of their research is available on the RNIB Insights web pages. And again, it comes back to the fact that we see a lot of children going up into secondary school, they then turn into young adults, they're then transitioning into adulthood, and in doing so they're not being taught necessarily the independent living skills that are needed to then move on and move out of home and move on with life. A lot of them struggle to find work placements. I mean, we know that 70% of adults with sight loss are unemployed. That's not a great marketplace as a young person to transition from secondary school education, whether you're then going into higher education, apprenticeship, sixth form, college, whatever it may be, then into the workplace, if you're facing that statistic alone. It is a difficult marketplace out there, trying to get apprenticeships, try to get people to engage with young people with sight loss and give them the opportunity and to make the adaptations that are needed to allow them to gain employment, despite the fact there is a lot of help and support out there through organisations such as Access to Work. And also, we also know that the academic world struggles to engage and to bring young people with sight loss along on their courses. Lots of things are very visual, presentations, and again, the preparation that's needed to be done beforehand. And it's just a very difficult, complex world out there. And it's about getting society to understand that actually it's not really that difficult to make reasonable adjustments to allow young people with a vision impairment to engage in exactly the same way as everybody else and to participate.
Is it just that reasonable adjustment, or does the committee feel there is something tangible that can be done to mitigate that transition period or the failings of that transition period?
Well, it's really interesting because there's already rafts of legislation, Equalities Act, everything that is out there. But yet we still have the figure in adults of 70%. Mm. And we still read and hear and see case studies of young people and the issues that they've struggled with at universities or apprenticeship or finding work, and they're still living at home because they can't, you know, move on because they can't afford to go anywhere. And, you know, it's a real societal issue. And from a very personal point of view, I don't just see it as a vision impairment issue. I see it as the disability world as a whole struggles with this. And for anybody that follows Channel 4 News and you watch the work that they have been doing around young people in employment, it is across the board. And there's a real societal change that has to take place for people to understand that actually the value that is added by employing anyone who is young and dynamic and keen and wants to go to work brings benefits to anybody's organisation, whether you've got a disability or not, it doesn't matter.
Do you think some of this is born out of the push that certainly was a feature of the 1980s, 90s and the early 2000s for everyone to have a higher education rather than actually saying for some people, actually a trade might be a really good way of getting you into the workplace and getting you into adult society?
I think it's a good question. I will go back to some of the case studies that RNIB have looking at, though, because some people have struggled with the apprenticeships and accessibility about learning a trade, etc. As a whole, we are seeing less people taking up places at university. A lot of that's down to cost, I would suggest, rather than majority of other things. But I don't know is the honest answer. But I just look at those adult statistics, and something somewhere needs to be unlocked. I don't have a magic wand. I don't have the answer, but I think that's a broader question for us as a sector, not just vision impairment, but the disability sector as a whole. And there are champions out there that are pushing those messages and pushing the way.
Lastly, as a topic area for the committee at the moment, Starting Point Project.
Yes, Starting Point is a great initiative that started with the committee probably about 5 years ago now. And what it's a very brief synopsis as to if you have a child or young person that has an identified potential vision impairment or identified vision impairment, basically it's a knowledge piece that tells you what is available, when it's available and what you should expect. And it gives you links out to all the various organisations that can help and support you, whether they be public sector or whether they be charitable sector. And it is a leaflet, and it's also available on the Vision 2020 website, and we shall keep it updated. But we refreshed it at the request of the Paediatric Ophthalmologists Committee, the few paediatric ophthalmologists that are out there who do the most incredible job for children and young people. They asked us to refresh the document to also refresh their knowledge so that when they were obviously looking at a child with a potential vision impairment or identifying and certifying or registering a vision impairment, that they could point children, young people and their parents in the right direction to get the help and support that we've been talking about for the last half an hour.
So we've talked about the work of the committee, but maybe we should touch on who the committee is. Who are the individual members who formulate the committee, and what do they bring to the table?
It is organisations that sit across the whole children and young people's pathway, from eye health right away through to the charitable side of things. So obviously you have guide dogs with myself and others sat around the table, RNIB in Action, Ron London Society for the Blind, Vision 2020 UK, Visionary, England Vision Strategy, the Royal College of Ophthalmologists, BIOS, Seeability, Sense, and we've just invited some new members to come along and join in as well.
So what do you see as some of the positive outcomes from the committee's work? Can you see anything that you're actually getting a tangible grip on and actually making a significant change?
I have to say, I personally have been very impressed in how the group has really got behind the messages that BIOS have been developing around eye screening. Mm-hmm. And I feel that it is starting to build more momentum and starting to get those messages out, because it is about being a voice that's some of the whole rather than just the individual members around the table. I think Starting Point is a really good example, because it was the Paediatric Ophthalmologist Committee that came to us and asked if we could review Starting Point, because they wanted to upskill their own knowledge and came to us to help them in doing so. I think there is a lot of work we've started to join up better around early years support, in particular amongst some of the charities that are working together in this field. What it is doing, it's encouraging all of us to sit round that table and to really think about, in everything that we do, who else should we be working with to ensure that children and young people do get what they need and want. And the great thing about the committee is the fact that everybody comes from their various large branded organisations that have their own strategies, but they're all left at the door when we all sit around the table, because we are all passionate, and at the heart of this is ensuring that children and young people with a vision impairment and their families and carers get the help and support that they need.
And we always ask this of contributors to the podcast: what do you think are some of the big topic issues about society and the barriers that society creates for children and young people?
I'm going to answer that as a parent. I think the pressures on children and young people this day start too young. I think we don't allow our children and young people to be children for long enough. And we expect them to be young adults from a very early age, from the minute they go to school. And everything is driven by targets, everything's driven by results, and pigeonholes children into brackets and labels at such a young age. And that somehow as a society we have to free ourselves from those shackles and broaden our minds and make sure that actually, you know, people grow and develop over years. And that's what it's about, and allow people to be themselves and be their own people and personalities in their own rights.
And it sort of mostly answers my next question, really. What do you think society and government could do, maybe even outside the scope of the committee, to improve the lives of vision impaired children and young people?
I think they need to lead by example. I mean, they need to really start challenging and pushing everything that they do to be inclusive. The amount of money our government spends on the NHS, on social care, but are they really measuring and looking at the social value? Are they really measuring that they're being inclusive, that they're including all communities? And I think they really need to challenge themselves on that.
And how do you think we can get vision impairments in children and young people higher up the agenda in terms of its profile for government, society, health, education?
We can only do that if we win over the public's hearts and minds in understanding what it means to be a child or a young person with a vision impairment and what that means to their families and carers in a way that they can emotionally engage, so that actually it's the power of the public that puts the pressure on the government, not just the groups of people that are having to do it at the moment.
Jenny Cook, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Vision 2020 UK.
For more information about this podcast, Vision 2020 UK and its members, get in touch via email
info@vision2020uk.org.uk,
on Twitter
at Vision2020UK
or via our website
www.vision2020uk.org.uk.
Produced by me, John Wellsman, at Sparrow's Rest.